Whether this is her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct is everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Taking a walk.
You know, I come from a very musical family, so I'm spoiled and ruined in that regard. I get in through the back door, you know. I walked in into my father's band rehearsal and thought that that's just how things are. There's a drum set and there's an amp. In that sense, Ukraine wasn't any kind of, a third world country that didn't know how it goes. Like, no, like, I grew up to, like, my dad rehearsing, like, Doors songs.
Welcome to this episode of the Taking a Walk podcast with your host, Buzz Knight. Buzz's guest is Eugene Hoots, a Ukrainian singer and composer and the front man for the hardcore punk band Gogol Bordello. Join Buzz and Eugene next on Taking a Walk.
Well, I'm Buzz Knight. I host the Taking a Walk podcast, and we love having in-person walks, but from time to time, it's virtual, so we're going to go to the virtual Taking a Walk hotline and special guest enter and sign in, please.
Oh, hello. Thank you for having me. I'm Eugene Hoots. I'm the lead singer of Gogol Bordello, songwriter, you know, New Yorker for the last 25 years.
Well, you are a man of diverse interests, and we're going to hopefully touch on that. But most importantly, first, I want to find out, how is your family in the Ukraine?
You know, people are holding up all right. I mean, it's kind of almost, impossible probably for a lot of people to imagine this situation. But Ukrainian people are pretty resilient and stoic on their historical hard drive. It's just things went in such a way that they build up these traits, you know, and that comes to its full service right now. You know, it's just absolutely mind-blowing what they could adapt to and how they persevere through it, you know, including my family. It's just quite large back there, you know. So it's important to stay in regular touch, you know, and let them know world is thinking about them and concerned with the same things, you know, with them.
Is there ever a moment where you feel they're giving up hope?
No. That's just something not on Ukrainian hard drive, you know, to put it in one sentence. It's nobody in Ukraine was, brought up with a silver spoon, and people who do well, they earn it. And there's a lot of, just down-to-earthness about it. Down-to-earthness and unwavering optimism, you know, which I know from my very own family very well, you know, because You oftentimes, especially being a transplant and an immigration, which is nothing in comparison to the war, you know, but that is still getting uprooted and tossed around and carving out a new place in a new culture. It still requires quite a degree of that, you know. Optimism is there. Some kind of genetic optimism, yeah.
Tell me about your last trip there.
Well, this was just in September. I was able to visit twice since the beginning of the war, which is less regular than usually I'm there every year. Well, I mean, this is also technically every year, but it's just, you know, it's important to get there and to, if you have capabilities of getting there and just spend face-to-face time, you know, because people there, they know that, you know, world supports them but it's different when they see it face-to-face, that people can't, you know, you come there and you spend time with them it's not by any means normal what they're going through, but there's a lot of layers of life that people just manage to be normal. Of course, there's air raids and sirens and all that right now, but it's a very different kind of war. I mean, you get app on your phone that warns you about air raid 15, 20 minutes ahead of time, and you go to the shelter or don't, you know. I've seen people just wave that and not really, you know, comply to the sheltering. But I think they should definitely shoot if they can, you know. It's kind of amazing to for them to master yet a flow of life, you know, doing their work, doing their studies, people continuing with what they do best, you know. I mean, academics keep working, you know, fashion people keep designing, you know, and, you know, musicians keep playing. Of course, it's in a very transformed, a lot of times, kind of unannounced and undisclosed locations. I mean, even when I played there, you know, I mean, the concerts were basically unadvertised and let no word of mouth in the last, in like 2 hours before it happened. You know, just things like that, you know.
Tell me how you got connected first to music.
You know, I come from a very musical family, so I'm spoiled and ruined in that regard. I get in through the back door, you know. I walked in into my father's band rehearsal and thought that that's just how things are. There's a drum set and there's an amp. So you're looking at it, you know. In that sense, Ukraine wasn't any kind of, you know, third world country that didn't know how it goes. Like, no, like, I grew up to, like, my dad rehearsing, like, door songs, you know. So, like, you know. I mean, it was an underground activity and wasn't by any means, you couldn't have any kind of career out of that. So it was a work of passion. And, you know, my father and his brother, who's a painter, Mikhailo, they had a lot of influence in me. Just, I kind of downloaded all their hipster accomplishments, you know, as I appeared into the cradle, you know, just next to my crib was standing at my dad's, you know, 8-track recorder with, you know, Beatles and Rolling Stones and Doors and Stooges and Velvet Underground and, yeah, and all the good stuff that was coming out, the Kraftwerk. Like, they were just so ahead of time that when I got into punk rock years later, you know, and on some party, finally, like some punk rock kids were like older than me a little bit, like my kind of sages. They were like, yo, forget all this like hardcore stuff you're listening to. This is the new stuff. This is like, and they played Kraftwerk. I was like, oh my God. Like, that, I heard it when I was like 3 years old, you know?
I only remember that one song by them, Autobahn.
Yeah, well, it's a great song, but it's just such an influential band, you know, that wrote the whole Bible of new aesthetic and of minimalism and, you know, went on to influence like Joy Division and all the bands that came out of Joy Division, you know, just highly influential bands. But I think that comes kind of from frequenting on my dad's rehearsals, which was not his main profession. That's, as I said, work of passion. But also a painter studio, you know, my uncle, you know, just those were just guys with like long hair and dirty pants with like covered with paint and, you know, just like smoked a lot and, you know, had a fireplace melting glass in the studio and blasting like some crazy ass prog rock, you know, you know, like playing like King Crimson. And, you know, I was like, yes. Sounded like, you know, it's like, that's the good hang, you know?
Sounds great.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't like all the time. It was kind of a sacred place that you'd go a few times a week. But I was familiar with those places and it was a home for me. So, you know, that went on to become more of a home for me later.
Tell me about the origins of the band Go Go Bordello and explain to the audience the background, you know, why the name of the band's important. Give them the lowdown.
Yeah, I can do that. I mean, over the years, I get to know how to put this book into three sentences.
Oh, come on. We've got time if you've got time.
Yeah, all right. So it doesn't have to be three sentences. Here we go. I guess kind of like did the kind of extra eccentric punk rock genre that we kind of known for, you know, the so-called gypsy punk, is the word out there on the street to describe the band. What does it mean? I mean, this was kind of actually a very pretty loose term for a very ambitious new kind of punk rock that we were set out to originate in the very beginning. And, you know, it was turn of the century time, was, you know, around 2000s. By that time, I was already playing numerous punk rock bands, hardcore bands, electronic industrial bands, and experimenting with all those things, you know, since I was a baby. And I just felt like, okay, I think punk rock is an amazing thing with all its diversity, but it kind of seems like it's running out of steam, you know? What else can we infuse it with? And on a parallel note, I guess semi kind of nostalgia for where I came from, where that all those melodies of that old world magic were kind of boiling up to me. You know, I was like already, it's been some years since I left Ukraine, and I kind of started really jonesing for these melodies. You know, it's just they were running through my veins. I mean, I was born and raised in a place outside of Kiev, which was populated. Yeah, I mean, Shalom Aleichem wrote the Tevye the Dairyman, which is the Fiddler of the Roof proto story, in where I was born and raised, in Boyarka, just 15 kilometers outside of Kiev. So that's a place with a very unique makeup. There is Romani population there, is Jewish culture, and traces of all that, like, deeply seated meltdown of you know, minorities, you know, Romani, Jewish, you know, Ukrainian. It's not a village, but it's not a suburb either. It's just like this unique town. There's still a well to get water from, but it was more on comparatively modern side by the time. Hanging out in there, you know, it's just kind of really left an impact. Those were my essential childhood memories, just going down a dusty road, stumbling into a wedding that people are having, having a band play, going into that wedding, you know, being treated as a, you know, as a regular because I live around the block. And when I was like 5, 6 years old, like doing my Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn activities, basically. And so that kind of started subconsciously, I guess, at that point, jonesing for recapturing that. And I thought, wow, you know, I have all this collection of gypsy music that I've been collecting over the years. I need to start putting that into my music. I need to start melting this into this one retro-futuristic vision. And the one thing that really helped me out with that is that I met here in New York City, I scouted out. I mean, I went after them. This was not accident. I like went after these people, after Sergey and Yuri are amazing, you know, virtuoso players who were virtuosos. Like, it's nothing that you meet too often in punk rock world. you know, guys with classical training, finished conservatory, and, you know, once I got them on a Google Bordello train, we became unstoppable because we had that unique vision of this retro-futuristic gypsy music-inspired punk rock with all those elements from early punk to and hardcore to classical music and everything in between. You know, that's really the kind of the genesis of, since you gave me more than a few sentences to describe, there it is. There is the matrix.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, and then the youths cut onto it, you know, and New York City is a very receptive place. People know it when they see it. They have a very great taste here. And in particularly, we were embraced by a scene that was kind of art punk scene and post-punk, which was pretty massive at that time. So all our upbringing years were, you know, playing with bands that were like Speedball Baby and Gunga Dan and Heroin Cheeks, you know, with like people from Swans and just like really, really all that New York Lower East Side art, good stuff that speaks through music, you know?
Yeah.
That was our scene.
So I know when you first came to the country, you first went to Vermont, but ultimately, do you feel there was something kinetic that was driving you to New York City?
Yeah, I was set on going to New York City. It was perhaps for the best that I went to Vermont first because, yeah, I mean, I didn't speak any English and yet back then, and it was kind of a gateway, you know? I mean, I would find my way around New York City as well because where I grew up in Kiev, moved to Kiev when I was 5 years old with my family, it was not so different from like growing up in the Bronx. Now that, you know, I know the city well, you know, it's just like similar, you know, desolate outskirt with a lot of project buildings that looked kind of unfinished. Because they were unfinished, actually. You know, I mean, the whole Soviet economy was so idiotic. It was just hustled and it was so corrupt. I mean, it was still Soviet Union back then. So it was so corrupted that they would have people moving in into unfinished buildings with like no windows. And, you know, like, yeah, it's ready to go. Just move in and put in your own fucking windows, you know. And then, you know, people would move in and put in their own windows. And the building was, you know, how unfinished buildings look, they're unpainted. There's no tiles. And
sure.
Then, you know, the corrupted government would just like, oh, okay, well, they're already living in there. So what the fuck? They like it. So I guess we don't have to really put the tiles in or paint it, you know. So you'd just be living in this kind of house that is you know, from the get-go looked like ghetto, you know. And now that district in Kiev is called Oblonь, is considered to be like actually one of the well-to-do districts. But for first 10 years of it, when we got in there, it was kind of like not so far away, not so far from like the Warriors movie, you know.
You're a historian, though, of sorts of music, and obviously when you made that move to New York, you were really honed in on, you know, some particular bands that had great influence on you. Talk about the bands at the time you moved in that were still part of, you know, the scene.
The reason why, even though while being in New York, while even being in Vermont for first years, I knew that I was gonna go to New York anyway, is because of Sonic Youth. This is the band that's kind of a central hypnotic force in my trajectory. Beyond their music being distinctly singular and innovative and just reaching a full, absolutely like a singular kind of frequency, you know, beyond that, they had a kind of a heroic knack to them, and they went to play in Ukraine in 1989, which was a revelation and really a miracle. This was a very still isolated time for Eastern Europe. And the only people who would go there, it's like, yes, Gorbachev already opened the gates and some Western musicians started to come in, but they were like Billy Joel, kind of mainstream rock and roll, musicians that had all their paperwork in order because they're massive entities. But for an underground band to go and play music that's extremely pioneering, that wasn't a thing. There was no established route. Even I ask my friends now who put on that show, they're like, we don't really understand how it all came together. I guess some guy from Latvia called and said that this progressive avant-garde band is doing some kind of a heroic stint through Europe, and we got them somehow to come in here to Vilnius. So the show in Kyiv happened. It was on the wings of Sonic Youth, one of their peak records, and band had many peaks. It was Daydream Nation tour. And wow, we were all considered ourselves at that point to be pretty savvy experts on all things alternative. We had a great connection with Berlin. We knew very well, like, Einstürze und Neubauten and Deutschland-Amerikanische Freundschaft and Birthday Party, you know, Nick Cave's old band, listening to Bauhaus and The Fall. And aside from, like, GBH and, you know, the kind of more usual kind of things for punk rock, PIL and Classic Pistols, of course. But this was, like, a completely another side of the whole music. The show was held actually not so far away from my home. I didn't know what to expect. I just kind of went there with my bandmates. It was like blowtorch in your face. You know, like all this alter tuning and resulted in such a hypnotical effect. And just the whole presentation that they were playing this art punk hardcore, but they looked kind of like normal people. Like, they kind of looked like professors from, like, younger professors from, like, a university. Had this kind of academic kind of a style to them in a certain way. All I need to know now after the show, all these tribal beats and all these songs that have this extended, instrumental, prolonged, cathartic sections, I'm going to go there where this music came from. Yeah, it's just, it was such a formative experience for a lot of people in Kyiv. Everybody who was there, all the 200-300 people that were there at that show, they were under a spell of it for sure, and remain to be under a spell of it. So I kind of knew that I need to go there where, like, that music had like a geographical aside to it. I was like, I need to land on that soil.
Yeah.
So that was kind of, I guess, the vector for me.
We'll be right back with more of the Taking a Walk podcast.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
All 12 episodes of The Passage are available now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Mr. Worldwide himself, Pitbull.
A lot of artists in general, people that are very creative, sometimes tend to overthink. That's one of my number one rules. Don't ever overthink. You can think ahead, but don't overthink. And what I mean by that is when they start to write a record, they're like, oh, that's not the line. Oh, that's not this. Oh, it's not that. And everybody has a creative process. I'm not knocking it. For me, I just let it flow.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Taking a Walk podcast.
Did you ever get to play at CBGB's while it was still around?
Yeah, of course. I got to play there several times. Before Gogo Bordello, I had another band, actually several bands, and we drove up from Vermont and played CBGB twice, and Coney Island High, I think even Continental. This was like 94, 95, 96. Even while living in Vermont, which is extremely art-spirited, probably have heard of legendary things about it, like, you know, Bread and Puppet events, 242 Main, a kind of a legendary now punk hardcore teen center, essentially teen center that was turned into this punk hardcore vortex where we played, you know, dozens of times. That was started by Bernie Sanders and his wife, Jean Sanders.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. That was kind of modeled after these teen centers that they had in Holland and Germany. Had a more European kind of way of running it, which was letting kids run it and letting kids book it. That's why, you know, everything like the most progressive hardcore bands of that time, like, you know, Shelter and, you know, Madball and Agnostic Front, Quicksand. Anyway, we just had like a train. It was like a revolving door of all the basically coolest music from DC and New York City and Boston, you know. So we were well exposed to everything. And if something wouldn't come our way, we could just go to Montreal, which was an hour and a half away, and see like Joan Spencer or Nine Inch Nails or Nirvana or, you know, Nick Cave. But yeah, we kind of, Fugazi played so many times in Burlington, and it was really influential.
You know, we had on a previous episode Danny Fields, so central to Lou Reed and obviously the Ramones. And we took a walk around the village. And when we got to the site of CBGB's, I mean, it really cuts at him not seeing CBGB's there. How does it make you feel when you see the absence of these places that have disappeared?
Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, Danny has such a, you know, impact on the whole history of everything, of everything cool. I was, you know, lucky to meet him and fulfill my thirst of knowledge of some of those things, you know. And he's such an incredible person to jive about that specifically. So I can see how that just can be traumatic It's not the same. Let's put it this way. For me, it's slightly less traumatic. But listen, I moved to New York City because Syracuse is the vector, but it was vector to that, to those national treasure institutions. It's partly traumatic for me too. This is probably what we should have begun with, because talking about having a walk through New York, I have a particular attachment to Alphabet City and Ukrainian village and all the Lower East Side, all the pockets of it, because I lived in for a long time and many places over there, but also because it's not that it's just CBGB and Coney Island High and Brownies and Pyramid and Sidewalk Cafe where I started over as a singer-songwriter. It's that it's in Ukrainian Village. It's a block away from Veselka. You know, Coney Island High, when I came in to play there, one of my old bands, around the corner, I would find that there's a Ukrainian restaurant next to the punk rock club. And there's a Ukrainian bar, just around the block from CBGB's. And there's a Ukrainian sports bar just around the block from Brownies. And I was like, what the fuck? This is magic. Like, this I could not, this is phantasmagory. Like, it's coming true.
Danny loved taking me over to the Ukrainian village area. I mean, that was very special. All was special, but for Danny, I could tell his very close, association and bond.
Yeah, and it's especially for, he has so much mileage in there and all these events. And I continue to discover up until these days amazing things about that. It's not that it's just cold Ukrainian village. I mean, the culture is there. Just scratch the surface and you'll find out that, like, New Order first show in New York City was in Ukrainian National Home. I was like, somebody told me about it. I was like, no way. Interesting. And then I looked it up and there was a picture of, Bernard Sumner, New Order on stage with a backdrop of Ukrainian poet, Taras Shevchenko. And yet, of course, it's in Ukrainian National Home. And then I scratched the surface farther and went to talk to people, the old timers who were there. And they're like, yeah, we had like Misfits and, Cro-Mags and everybody else play here on a regular basis. I mean, why is that a surprise? I mean, Ukrainians love music. I was like, damn, that's some incredible history. How did that come together? And they were like, well, they didn't have any place to go. And, we love to party. So we had to just play here and let's make a deal. And so we did.
Oh, wow.
So it's like goes on and on. Similar with Polish community too. I mean, as you know, one of the venues, Warsaw, it's just Polish national home converted to a very successful, awesome venue in Greenpoint. And, Ukrainian Polish people are very kindred spirits. And many of the venues that we play across the country, especially in early tours, we played a lot of great venues in Cleveland and Chicago that were basically old Polish, Ukrainian, Latvian social halls that were remodeled as venues for rock and roll.
Don't hang up on me. Jakszymasz.
Yeah, that's Polish. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. That's all I've got. That's all I got.
No.
Tell me about, you play worldwide, so tell me about some of your favorite places all over the globe that you love playing.
I'd say, well, there's two kind of different ways to answer that. Culturally, I'm kind of a really huge fan of Japan and Latin America. Of course, they have very distinct culture, and so a lot of that is very appealing and just awesome when you get there. It's a bit of a sense that you landed on a different planet. They have their own way of running things, and lifestyle is distinctly different. And the audiences are super, enthusiastic And as you know, Japan is extremely, you know, well-informed and super receptive to anything that's new. So we always did super well in Japan and played awesome shows, actually with Sonic Youth, one of the festivals. And, you know, people just there get so excited. It's like, I remember we played a festival and it was during the earthquake. But then when we got off the station, you know, there was news that there was an earthquake during the show and that there's one more coming probably later on in the evening. But the promoter still asked us to play an after party. We like played another show like a couple hours later. It seemed like they had a hold on things and things were supposed to work out, and work out they did. Only when we got to a hotel and partying and I start seeing from the balcony, from we were like on 50th or 60th floor on a balcony, and I start seeing the pool downstairs. It just kind of looks like, you know, a glass of water if you just shake it in your hand, just splashing all over the place. And I was like, well, that's okay, it's that thing. Anyway, nothing went off the rails. That kind of will stick in your mind, you know?
Oh, yeah, I'd say.
The festival didn't stop, just the life went on as normal. That was pretty suitable earthquake. I mean, water was splashing pretty far out of the pool.
Yeah, I'd say. You know? Jeez. That gets etched pretty severely in your brain, right?
Yeah, I don't know. By the time I had like, you know, 12 Roman Cokes, so I was eased into it, you know?
Tell me how your acting career began and has evolved.
I don't know. There's really a way to call it career. I mean, yeah, I was in several movies. It would be a career if I'd pursue it.
Acting hobby then. How's that?
Yeah, okay. That works. You know, Everything is Illuminated is the first movie that kind of fell out of the sky. Probably there's some sense of so-called law of attraction that was at work, because it was kind of several things were aligning with that. A friend of mine, a Ukrainian artist, you know, gave me a book, Everything is Illuminated, just literally like a month or 2 months before the news of this film casting came up. I actually kind of poked around it and didn't really read it, but I thought it was interesting and the way it's written in such an unorthodox way. And I think that the writer of the novel, he came to my party in Bulgarian bar, and another writer told me about it, you know, so it was kind of on my radar. A movie, people reached out and said that we're making this Eastern European kind of spirited movie, and would be great if you could maybe collaborate on soundtrack for that. You know, your band kind of has a knack for that. And I was like, yeah, okay, let's meet up. And it was only during the meeting, it was really music that led me onto it, you know. It was during the meeting that Liev Schreiber, you know, who directed the movie and kind of was, hey, like, listen, okay, well, music is one thing, but you, my friend, done any acting by any chance too? You know, I had an eye for it, you know. It's like, maybe you should come in for a screen test tomorrow. So I was like, yeah, well, I'm not opposed to it. I guess that went okay, because like 3 weeks later, I was, you know, doing rehearsals for the film in Prague, where the production was set. So once again, music led to that. Acting is something you can, I guess, wing to a certain extent, but it is a very different lifestyle altogether. You can't really wing that lifestyle. It's just an absolutely different way of living. I mean, you have to wake up at 6 a.m. and that's like when I go to bed. It's a drastic change of lifestyle. So when everybody after, you know, that film had really great reviews and was like, actually, people still keep discovering it. And so one of those like revered kind of pictures, you know. Yeah, I was like really encouraged by a lot of people. Like, hey, you got to like move to LA and do that whole thing. Yeah, you winged it and you can wing a lot more of it. But you got to still do all the, you know, legwork and do all these castings and get up in the mornings and do all that stuff. And it's not so much getting up in the morning. I've get up plenty of times in the morning to go and do music, radio and all that stuff. And, you know, TV and all those TV shows are shot very early in the morning and aired at night. So Whether you got 30 minutes of sleep or 2 hours of sleep, nobody cares. You just wake up and you go and do it. I was just like, let me meditate on this for 5 seconds. The answer is no. I don't want to move to LA and I don't want to abandon my lifestyle. I'm a night owl. I'm a night owl kind of workaholic. It's a kind of a thing that tags along with Gogol Bordello folklore, you know, partying and festive activities. But my way of partying is basically a maniacal workaholism, of things that I like to focus on.
So what are you working on now? What are you focusing on now?
Well, exactly. Last night I went to bed at 6:30 a.m. because I was mixing my new project, Puzzle Panther, which is a new band that I play in and also produce with Brian Chase from Yeah Yeah Yes, another iconic New York City band. And also coming from that bubble of, you know, turn of the century bands that I was talking about earlier, was a very fertile time. There's a lot of interest in that era now. I can see why, because some really, really amazing bands came out and artists, you know, Regina Spektor also started out in Sidewalk Cafe, meaning restarted, you know, I mean, I restarted there under great curation of Lutch. There was a great guy who was also a songwriter. I think he lives in UK now, but he was running that kind of, he called it anti-folk fest kind of a thing, and open mic nights. And he was really for kind of impresario kind of a knack to him, where he could just tell people right away who came in for the first night on open mic. You know, he'd be like, listen, that was good. Why don't you take like a Thursday night and, you know, and do a set. And, you know, he kind of helped Gogol Bordello. Back then we called Hoots and the Bella Bartoks, the first formations, you know, of it. Regina remembers him very, you know, warmly. So anyway, circling back, this new project, Puzzle Panther, is a band that kind of speaks of kind of New York continuity. You know, the principal songwriter in the band is not me. It's not really my band. It's Victoria Espinoza, who's a lead singer. She's the principal songwriter, very strong, brilliant new songwriter. Her friend, Kay Bontempo from Bushwick, they work out material that just like, you listen to it and you just like can tell that they kind of grew up on a steady diet of Ramones and Yeah Yeah Yes and Talking Heads and Sonic Youth once again. And Blondie, and there's a bit of grunge in it, but it's kind of dancing around that New York cool thing that, you know, Velvet Underground started.
That's tremendous. That's tremendous.
And you want to get behind things like that because it's just, New York City has such an incredible musical legacy, and like, we don't want to see it slip away, you know, like, no.
Got that right.
Yeah, I mean, come from New York City that go on influencing entire world. Yeah, it might get hyped like crazy in London and receive all the stamp of approval from NME and the rest of the British press before it like gets blown up worldwide, but kind of originates here. It's like a New York City's kind of workshop, you know.
So in closing, what would you like to learn that you haven't learned about creating music, producing music, whatever?
Wow. I guess one of the things is I naturally found myself in this like a position of producer over the years because I produced or at least co-produced all Gogol Bordello records with amazing people like, you know, Rick Rubin and Steve Albini and Victor Van Vugt, you know, Andrew Sheps, Walter Schreffels. I worked with a lot of amazing people who have a very serious insights into how great music gets captured. And they made some sidebar notes along the way. It was a natural time for me to start applying a lot of the engineering and musical impresario skills to projects that inspire me. It's just basically as simple as that. Like Puzzle Panther is just in my immediate vicinity, you know, and our bass player is also, you know, he's a He was also born and raised in Ukraine, been living here for 25 years, just like me. I'm very close to that band in particular. But there's new bands popping up in the city. And I think that historically, it's an important moment to chime in on as much as you can to preserve that continuity, because pandemic kind of fractured the scene in a lot of ways. You know, I mean, it was already pretty fractured for other reasons. There was a kind of scene, a powerful scene in Findisickle till about 2005, 6, 7. But when all our friends became successful, a lot of them did, the scene dispersed. Everybody was just out on tour all the time. Of course, new bands form all the time, but there was something magical about that particular wave that we were part of. I didn't feel like there was quite such a cluster momentum afterwards. Listen, turn of the century is not nothing. It's a special astrological time. And of course, there was some astro help on that. It's like an open portal. People are more open-minded. You know, they want to get rid of old crap, and they were more open-minded. And then I think people just get more closed-minded and seem kind of dispersed a little bit. And then pandemic was just really messing with everyone. So now, you know, anything that's kind of has like a fountain-like energy, regardless of its style, you know, you just kind of want to support it because, you know, we need it. I mean, we need new good music.
Now more than ever, right?
Yes, seriously. And agitated music, that stylish music with a touch of anger to it is kind of coming back, you know? Or some of it is driven by anger because the world became a very distorted place again. You know, so it's a matter of therapy, really, to procreate this kind of art that can be healing.
Amazing. Eugene, boy, we scooped up almost an hour here, and I feel like we just got started. I'm very grateful for your time.
Yeah, like, it was a pleasure talking, for sure.
I really enjoyed it, and I wish you well. I wish your family well.
Thank you so much.
And our heart is there, and I'm grateful that you were on Taking a Walk, albeit virtual.
Thank you for having me, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Taking a Walk podcast. Share this and other episodes with your friends and follow us so you never miss an episode. Taking a Walk is available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Binge this season of The Passage now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listen to the highly anticipated 100th episode of Tank and Jay Valentine's R&B Money Podcast with artist Chris Brown.
even working with you from Kerry Hilson, Adonis, back in the day, I was 15, 14 doing that album. So like I said, I was in school, like, okay, this is how you do it. This is how you make a song. There's a verse, a pre-chorus, and then a hook. I didn't know none of that.
You learned that over a summer, bro.
That's what it felt like.
That's what it felt like.
Listen to R&B Money on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.